instructing the British and American way of speaking in the only proper way is a colonizing practice intended to intimidate, silence, and ultimately create a social hierarchy based on how well you speak that language in the Anglo-American way. Now, if you think that I'm being unfair by only picking on the English department, I do have other examples. For instance, just imagine the arrogance it takes to have a department called American Studies without even ever hinting that America is not only the United States. I must acknowledge that American Studies department has many courses on minorities in the United States, but can this be the justification for erasing Central and South Americans from their students as well as their faculty's intellectual map? And then there is SHAPS, the Constituent and Connected School of Hawaiian, Asian, and Pacific Studies, and the constituent and connected body of faculty from various departments, extending from the beloved philosophy department, political science, to natural sciences. This magnificent bastion of area studies, where a mostly Western and Western-trained faculty, and of course, the exception of Hawaiian studies, studies other people's habits, values, politics, etc., makes this a unique university, they say. But the bottom line is colonialism. Habits are deconstructed, people from all over the world are objectified, their psyches overanalyzed, but none of these analyzed things ever make a dent into the mind of their examiners. As Edward Said, the Palestinian writer and Israeli critic, says, the analyzers mostly never listen to what the people they study say, as they analyze them and their practices. Hence, the people of Asia and the Pacific merely become cases to prove or disprove theoretical models already fully developed within the walls of Western academia. Careers are made, competing notions of the third world are constructed without the presence of examined practices. What does all this thing mean for our students? I would argue a pretty dismal learning experience. What makes this university different, of course, is that the student body itself mostly belongs to the overanalyzed group. Remember, Hawaiians are lazy, the Japanese are diligent, Filipinos are unsophisticated, etc. Of course, we are becoming a bit more sophisticated these days. No more outright stereotypes, at least in mixed company. But we cannot shed our colonial demeanor. Let us think about that oft-repeated warning every new faculty, including me, receives from colleagues about local students not speaking in the classroom. Much time is spent analyzing the phenomena. The Center for Teaching Excellence even kills many trees, pondering on the issue. And as a political science student, Cindy Kobayashi, recently pointed out, some more liberal faculty members even take credit for helping these poor souls to come out of their shells and speak in the classroom, as though inequalities in this university will suddenly vanish when the students speak in the classroom. The concern is having the student come out of their shells, but never, never, as this very bright student wrote, is there any attempt to understand what their shells are about. The faculty never listens anyway. Why should the students tell their stories in the classroom? For all we know, it could be that we are deadly boring in the classroom. It may be that what we say and the way we say it, at least partially connects to the experience of some folks on the continent, but not here. Here, I must acknowledge that self-criticism has not been one of the colonizers' strengths. I have painted a pretty dismal picture here about the working of this university. But I do not want to leave you here because I think it is very important not to talk about this university as a monolithic entity. As we have come to see very blatantly in the past few years, and especially in the past few months, there is resistance. Hawaiian Studies is a good example, but there are also pockets of resistance in other departments and programs, including English, American Studies, and SHAPS. I am convinced that it is because of these resisted pockets that this university becomes a contested terrain in the ideal academic sense. If these resisted pockets did not exist, there wouldn't be any academic dialogue in this university, any relevant dialogue in this university. Debates are generated, the university is forced to change its practices, not because of the colonizers' anonymity, but because of concerted, untiring resistance coming mostly from students, but also some faculty. But let us not forget the dominant faculty's ability to counterattack. As Hanani K. Chow's case has shown, some of our faculty know no limits. They are ready to contradict themselves, co-opt the issue of student rights to attack one of the very few Hawaiian faculty, and even willingly offer to abdicate some of their own academic rights, as it was discussed in the Faculty Senate, in order to silence Hanani and by implication other faculty who oppose the system. Here I would like to remind you that colonialism has always had a liking for preferring order over individual rights. Hence, under various administrative colonialism, martial law and curfews were very much the preferred mode of operation, despite inconveniences for the colonizers as well. After all, the colonizers knew that curfews can always be curbed for them. Fortunately, attempts to curb individual rights have not worked so far in terms of an actual reprimand being handed out by our beloved president. But we now know a lot more about the viciousness of this system, and it is important that we learn from the intellectual tactics used not only to discredit Hanani K. Chow, but also the Hawaiian cause. And it is important to understand these intellectual tactics as yet another manifestation of colonialism. So what were the nature of attacks on Hanani? Interestingly enough, however, true to the North American obsession with procedures, the first and foremost attacks were not at all substantive. We acknowledge Hanani's right to talk about her politics as long as it is not abusive to students, they say. These sudden champions of student rights apparently do not have any problems with Hanani's argument, but only her style. So with one sweeping stroke, they not only accused Hanani of student abuse, but also insulted her supporters' intelligence. They wanted us to believe that what Hanani says doesn't bother them. It is the way she says it that bothers them. Now, this is a very well-known colonial technique, always wondering about the ethics of the opposition's tactics. Their own tactics are considered to be ethical, and the evidence is that they are practicing it. And hence, because they are practicing it. As a side comment, this is the same process that ends up calling the Iraqi Scud attack on the U.S. military quarters, which led to the death of 28 American soldiers as a terrorist act, and the flying of close to 100,000 Allied sorties over Iraq as just war. Now, when it was pointed out to me, sophisticated, or more sinister intellectual maneuver were here. Those making it usually introduce themselves as the more liberal folks. But they also avoid the larger issue of Hawaiian sovereignty or the immigration of Yoko. They are, of course, publicly disdainful of the philosophy department's attack on Honolulu tracks. But what they chastise the philosophy department for is their stupidity. They prefer not talking about the issue at all. What the philosophy department did was simply to cause unnecessary agitation. Sitting very comfortably in their offices, these faculty members become area specialists on the University of Hawaii. They analyze, overanalyze, deconstruct, find very interesting processes at play, but ultimately worry about the increasingly dangerous racial environment on campus and the effects that they have on free expression of their ideas. But what do they think about sovereignty issue? For that matter, what do they think about the United States bombing another country into oblivion? The answers to these questions are quite complicated and comes after long pauses intended to give assurances that a critical mind will work. Are you wondering what the answers are? Well, I am too. What I hear over and over again is that same line of no answers, that reality is very complex and multi-layered, and there are different interpretations. Struggling to get out of this ocean of interpretation, I take a breath and ask the same question: are you for Hawaiian sovereignty or not? At this point, I'm bombarded with the age-old academic colonial tactic, incomprehensible and totally meaningless tapestry of words and sentences, which is intended to tell me that I have a very uncritical and uninteresting mind. Of course, these are bare words. The theory of goodness that I am speaking. As an afterthought, I am referred to this or that great author, usually French, who has written extensively about the urge, or more properly, the will to look for easy answers. In one easy move, for them, of course, I am psychologized and my attitude problematized. I am told that I am morally righteous, and this makes difficult for them to have a dialogue with me. By the way, this may be one of the side effects of inhabiting a colonial institution. I have never been in any place where the term morally righteous is so easily thrown at politically active people, and is clearly intended to be an insult. I wonder what is the proper way of being morally unrighteous. In any case, after all this, I of course am still wondering whether they are for the war or against the war, sovereignty or against sovereignty. I also wonder what would happen if some of these well-respected intellectual giants would take a public stance for Hawaiian rights or even a better treatment of the local population within the university. And as I mentioned above, there are very few who have. I usually end up not dwelling on this issue for very long. Resistance to colonial practices must and does come from Hawaiian and local students and faculty. If the past 2 years are any measure, things will be harder for the largely Hawaiian faculty in this university as their teaching techniques and intellectual practices become challenged in public forums as well as within the classroom. Unfortunately, as the actions of the philosophy department and its supporters in the faculty senate and Boston Hall have shown, some would rely on any possible technique from outright force to intellectual manipulation to fight back. I hope that this will be a losing battle for them, and I thank God that there are some people who do politics in order to make a division battle.
Thank you. time. Noel Rich is a PhD at the University of Wisconsin in political science, and he's been with ethnic studies ever since I can remember, and even before. So, Noel Kent. Presenting a vision
of new alternatives in a different society which serves all of our people, not just the political and economic elites and those who don't even reside in Hawaii, but own and control us in so many different ways. I think we can begin to provide a faculty, we can try and provide a, begin to provide an education which critically challenges the values and goals of an imperial and consumerist and self-destructive culture. I think as public people, we must provide skills and support to communities throughout Hawaii which are seeking to maintain local lifestyles. We must offer alternative values, political points of view, perspectives, programs, which present alternatives to the tyranny of money, capital, greed, and development run amok, which are dominant in Hawaii. We must begin to commit ourselves toward restructuring the political and economic institutions of Hawaii, and it is only through restructuring that we can begin to talk about justice for Native Hawaiians, we can begin to talk about social justice for all the people of Hawaii. We must seek to demystify and demythologize the great and prevailing hegemony of beliefs in Hawaii today. We must avoid any attempt, which is always very tempting, to further mystify and further confuse the issues in Hawaii today. We must seek to build a university which is truly multi-ethnic, democratic, non-sexist, and supports the aspirations of Hawaii's people for decent and meaningful lives. Thank you.
Been a British colony that used to be called all of the 100 years. Colonial system and racism seem to be part of the air that we breathe. My father lost his position in the medical service for openly challenging the racism of his wife's periods. I was caned in school for questioning the Christian doctrine, for speaking my own language in defiance of school rules, and for attempting to engage my British teachers in intellectual debate. Colonialism has several characteristics. The first characteristic is political domination of one nation over another, such that control and decisions are imposed from the outside. That was the case with the British, the Solomons, and with Americans in Hawaii. Second, colonialism involves economic exploitation for the colonies and natural resources, including cheap labor and using the colony as a forced market to feed its workers. This was true in the Solomon Islands, and economically, Hawaii is fairly still the colony of the United States. Third, colonialism involves suppression of indigenous cultures and languages because they are a hindrance to the process of exploitation. Moreover, they are seen to stand in the way of progress and development for the local natives, or of their assimilation in the terms of the dominant political power. In the Solomons, as in Hawaii, the Christian missions and colonial government work together to crush our resistance. They call this pacification. And indoctrinate us with various values and ways of thinking. They call this education. Here in Hawaii, the Hawaiian language was banned for many decades as a language of instruction, and only recently has it been reintroduced for that purpose for a few public school children in the Hawaiian language immersion program. Fourth, colonialism nearly always includes racism, because racism rationalizes the colonial notion that one group is inherently superior to another, and therefore has the right of domination. Under colonialism and racism, such people become dehumanized, and their lives governed by stereotypes. My people were called savages, natives, black boys, Paziwazis. To the white colonialists, we were stubborn, untrustworthy, superstitious, and violent. I grew up hearing stories of Solomon plantation workers too sick with malaria to work in the fields, being beaten by British bosses who thought they were just merely lazy. It doesn't pay to resist the white overlords, of course. When the Solomon Islander tried to organize a workers' union to prevent this kind of thing from happening and to improve working conditions generally, he was labeled as a troublemaker and a psychotic by the British government. And laborers from both the private and public sectors in Drenton forfeited their jobs. Today, in Hawaii, we have just seen that it is acceptable for whites and Asian Americans to limit the rights of Hawaiians, for instance, prevent them from having the right to sue the state. But when a native Hawaiian woman, Kalani K. Trust, exercises her academic freedom to speak out about oppression, she is attacked from all sides, called a racist, and threatened with loss of her job. Some of you do not understand the frustration and anger that oppressed people feel. I have written about colonialism, and I have lived under colonialism. And let me tell you, the two are not the same. Writing about colonialism from an academic point of view is very different from living under colonialism. We in the third world who are struggling against colonialism, neo-colonialism, and internal colonialism, post-colonial elites, appreciate the support and good work of leftist academics and political activists who, living in colonizing countries, have the courage to write about colonialism and racism, but they need to realize that they can never understand the impact colonialism and racism have on those of us who suffer under it. They don't know the depth of humiliation that comes with being called primitive or being told that your value and intellectual capacity is less than that of white people. 15 years ago, I came to study in the land of the free. Americans liberated my country from the Japanese in World War II, and the Soviets told us about American democracy. To this day, older Solomon Islanders idealize America. They wish that Americans, rather than the British, had colonized them. They think things would have been different. They haven't been to Hawaii. Imagine my surprise. surprised when I first came to Hawaii in 1974 and discovered that Native Hawaiians were an oppressed minority in their own country, and that their lawfully constituted government was overthrown by Americans in the late 1800s. American soldiers had told us that we control British control just as they had in the American Revolution. They didn't tell us that the Americans had massacred natives, its native peoples on the mainland, and turned away into a permanent colony. Despite their claim to be a center of liberal and rational thought and equal opportunity, universities in the United States reproduce the colonialism and racism of a larger society. They do so in the bureaucratic and academic structures, in what they define as knowledge, in the way that knowledge is generated in universities, and in the pedagogical apparatus through which that knowledge is transmitted. The University of Hawaii is a state school whose mission is to serve the local community. Yet, the university is strangely remote from its community. The ethnic composition of its faculty, as so many have pointed out before me, is overwhelmingly white. The gender composition of its faculty is overwhelmingly male. All of the public statements that administrators have made about the university's commitment to justice and racial equality, there has been remarkably little action. In fact, everything about the University of Hawaii reflects its origin in white male mainland culture. A characteristic of education under colonialism is that knowledge is defined and controlled by the colonizing power. The colonized are required to learn what the colonizers define as knowledge. Local knowledge, that is knowledge of the subject culture, is devalued and sometimes outlawed. It is the colonizers who have the right to generate new knowledge, not the subject people. Information about the condition of being colonized is always restricted in the colonial institution. I came to America for higher education because I wanted a different educational experience from the British school in the Solomons, where we learned how Europeans had discovered the Pacific, as the islanders were merely part of the flora and fauna. Konami Trust used the word insects. Ethnologists have to have insect study of the same native people. They have to have us to study us. Our British teachers saw to it that we learned all about the heroism of European wars and aggression, but they taught us almost nothing about island history. We read Western philosophy, and though you might not believe it from the recent speeches and behavior of faculty in the philosophy department here at UH, there's a lot to be learned from Western philosophy. But in the culture which has great things and great ideas, every culture except ours, as our teachers saw it. I have found higher education in the U.S. to be extremely liberating experience, and I have had some excellent teachers at UH. Yet most of what I've learned of the truth of colonialism and its impact on native people in the Pacific has come not from the classroom, but from my own reading in the library and my own research. What are the patterns of colonialism I see repeated here at the University of Hawaii? First, understand that I am not arguing against good scholarship or good science, because I believe in these things. But for people of color, succeeding in the university carries with it the danger of being reshaped to think like white males think, and to lose the unique perspective of one's own culture. The goal should be to become bicultural and to retain one's ability to critique, but that's very difficult to do. One of my concerns is that scholars of the science are defined very narrowly here at the university, shown narrowly as close up alternatives and diversity. Related to this, faculty attitudes towards students of color automatically place such students at a disadvantage. Students' intelligence and excellence are typically measured by a highly schema, which include being quick with words and articulate in class, being fluent in highly forms of discourse, mastering highly versatile theory and method, knowing the stock of background knowledge that Howley already know, competing and debating in the context of Howley values and expectations. Other forms of knowledge and other ways of expressing what is known are excluded from the universal discourse and treated as inappropriate, irrelevant, unscientific, and meaningless. Of course, it is only forms of knowledge, but who is seen to have important knowledge? I have repeatedly observed in my classes that great interest is shown by the professors when a white student wants to report his or her experiences in a third world country. The professor listens attentively and asks the student a lot of questions. But when a third world student wants to talk about personal experience, the professor typically shows less interest and asks few questions. And some professors have gone to sleep on me. So why is the experience of people of color less important than the experience of white people? Why are the white outsiders' observations of more value than those of the insider who happens to be a person of color? Why is it assumed that the outside observer is a better observer than the insider? Similarly, I have repeatedly noticed that white professors tend to take more time during office hours with a white student than with a student of color. Is this just my imagination? No. This is an issue that I have discussed, not only with other students of color, but also with white students. And both have agreed that it is true. This issue may sound rather trivial to some of you, but I raise it because last week, Professor Catherine Takara called for her colleagues at the university to demand those students of color. The university is colonial in another way that speakers preceding me have already pointed out. That is, far from being a question of the left is politically correct, as conservatives judge, to a third world student, the university is most often a question of apologism for the terror, domination, and destruction of native people. Here in the US, we are far more likely to hear about Nazi Germany or Japanese persecution of the Chinese than to hear about the genocide, aggression, racism, and colonialism of white Americans against its own ethnic minorities, its territories, and its third world targets. The ways in which colonialism and racism are practiced daily on this campus would make a very long list. Some are subtle, others obvious, but all are recognized and felt by students of color. I'm glad for the opportunity to speak tonight. It doesn't happen often for students of color. And I'd like to express my appreciation to the Max Miller Institute for Peace for organizing these forums over the past month. Clearly, our campus needs to have more public discussions of race, colonialism, and related topics. The issues we are discussing are not new, nor are they unique in this university. The way the university has handled the Michael Lamb case, sexual harassment issue, the Carter Trust debate, affirmative action, the recruitment of minority, especially Hawaiian students, has been extremely discouraging and is very painful. I don't think we can count on change being initiated from the top at this university. And I believe that. If we want something to change, then we, students, staff, and faculty, have to unite and work together to bring it out. Thank you.
I'm going to take some time. I was invited to participate at the Wichita State University seminar on the Holocaust, and I was the only non-academic who participated in that. Now, I was introduced as a mixed-blood Indian, and I want to say part of what that means. Basically, it means my father was an Indian and my mother was a Congregationalist. My father was born and reared on the Cattaraugus Reservation, full-blood Seneca Indian, and he was taught somewhere along the line that one of the solutions to the American Indian problem, and this is the colonial enterprise, was to become absorbed into through the skills of developing the way of the mainstream. He left the reservation when he was about 15 or 16, one never knows, and eventually met a woman who was a descendant of the English settlers. My genealogy is not always clear on my father's side, but it has been made very clear to me that I'm a direct descendant of Chief Red Jacket of the Senecas, that my Indian name is Goswami, which pretty translated means Red Jacket, and the most interesting ancestor I can find on the white side of my family was hung at the age of 83 in the Witch in Salem. So I assume she was a non-colonial too. Primarily of five people. The mother, the father, the boy, the girl, and the anthropologist. So there is analyzing being done on the mainland, too. Back during the Vietnam War, they undertook a poll to find out how American Indians felt about the Vietnam War. And about 65 to 70% of them said the United States should get out of Vietnam, but 99% said the United States should get out of North America. On the reservations where I worked, unemployment routinely ranges from 75 to 90%. There is no possibility of economic development because nobody wants to develop economically in those isolated, godforsaken, barren, resourceless areas. Alcoholism runs from 90 to 95%, with 100% of the families either having practicing or active alcoholics in them, or having recovering alcoholics in them. It becomes an oxymoronic kind of community of codependence. 25% of Indian children born in the Great Plains in North and South Dakota are now fetal alcohol syndrome babies. One out of four. Now let's talk about colonialism, shall we? I think enough horror stories have been told tonight. I just wanted to let you know that I could tell to you also. What I want to do is, because I'm the only non-academic, maybe I have a perspective about the university that might be a little different. So let me get around to that in sort of a non-direct, non-lineal, right-brained kind of way. It would appear to me that one of the prime legacies of colonialism in the world today is that we now have sort of a single economic, financial, technical unit. And with the decline of the Second World following the collapse of communism as we have known it, it now will become global. And that the action in Iraq was certainly a major nail in the coffin of any diversity along that line. Peoples who are organized by different beliefs and customs, in other words, indigenous and ethnic folks like us, get sucked into this series of economic processes that are called development. And for the most part, resistance appears to be ineffective. When I go to a meeting of American Indians on the mainland, And if there is more than one tribe available there at the meeting, we have to speak in English. Every time I am there, we can always find somebody who is punished for speaking their Indian language. While on the Navajo reservation, I talked to one of the code talkers. Do you know what a code talker is? A Navajo code talker? During the Second World War, it was apparent that the American military needed to find ways of communicating from ship to shore and from the air. And they had broken some of the Japanese codes, and they wanted a code they couldn't break. So naturally, they turned to the Navajo folks. And these Navajos would just sort of chat with each other and tell each other what was going on. And Navajo being one of the most complex languages in the world, is that correct? You're the linguist. Is clearly difficult for somebody else to pick up. So one of these code talkers was telling us in one of the stories about that, that here he was when he was a kid growing up in grade school, he was punished severely whenever he spoke Navajo. And after the Second World War, he was well rewarded by that same government. Resistance by and large to this development process is growing more and more. The human aspect of all of this, of course, is the development of beliefs, attitudes, and skills together, which enables people to enter this process is called modernization. Now,